From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made in 2006 in a small West African nation called the Gambia. President Yahya Jammeh had been president for about the last 12 years following a military coup. And history shows that after military action leads to the installation of new presidents, there often isn't a lot of hope for ousting that president in future elections. They stay for a long time. They know how to hold on to power. Leading up to the 2006 election, President Jammeh said, quote, "Even the birds know that I am going to win because I have done so much for this country," end quote. But that is debatable. Jammeh has also been quoted as saying that he would help the regions that vote for him, and for those that don't, they would get nothing. So fast forward to late 2016. Once again, President Jammeh was running for re-election, but once again, the world community assumed it would know the outcome in advance. This time, Gambians elected Adama Barrow in an upset. And perhaps more surprising, President Jammeh initially said he would accept the results. That didn't last. Jammeh later declared a national emergency and seemed ready to fight to hold on to power. It was a crisis for the small nation that had already struggled with migration, refugees, and questions about political freedom, political prisonership. But after 72 hours, Barrow struck a deal with Jammeh, who is now in exile. Most of us don't know much about this small country, and it's an opportunity to understand how the concentration of political power can create a crisis when it comes to, well, all kinds of things, economics, human rights, refugees, that impact the wider world. And today, Gambians who fled in recent years might be wondering if they're on the brink of having the door open to return home, while Gambians who have remained are on edge, but maybe optimistic about what happens next. We have a lot to learn. Let me go ahead and welcome our guests for the hour. Benjamin Lawrence is the Connable Chair and Director of International and Global Studies at RIT. Welcome back, Benjamin.
Thanks very much for having me.
And on the line with us is Asan Sarr. He's an Assistant Professor of History at Ohio University and just published Islam, Power, and Dependency in the Gambia River Basin, The Politics of Land Control, 1790 to 1940. Nice to have you, Mr. Sarr. Thank you for taking the time.
Thank you very much. Happy to be on.
Benjamin, I want to just make sure we understand some of the history, and I want to tell our listeners right out of the gate here, if you don't know much about the Gambia, if you can't find it on a map, I mean, you're certainly not alone here, but I think these are the moments that, number one, it's important to learn, and number two, it's important to understand that in this global community now, I mean, human rights and concern about political freedoms and all kinds of things can impact all of us. So the history of the Gambia goes back to, well, I guess there haven't been that many elections or leadership changes if you go back to, what, the 1960s or so, right?
Right. So, you know, one of the reasons why I thought this might be interesting to your listeners is because we've been talking a lot about refugees.
Yep.
And what makes people flee their country and why they have to flee in order to seek protection. And the Gambia is a country quite extraordinarily so that it has produced more refugees per capita than any other country in West Africa. And in last year alone, the fifth highest number of arrivals from across the Mediterranean into Italy by boat were people from the Gambia. So Gambia was a pretty despotic country for a very long time. The outgoing, now ex-president, was in power for 22 years. And he was only the second president, and he seized power in a coup, and that was the first change of power. So this is only the third president in Gambian history, and it's only the first time that there has been an election that has produced a democratic outcome and a relatively peaceful transition in power.
Let me read what the New York Times recently wrote about the departure of Yahya Jammeh from the Gambia. Quote, "Mr. Jammeh first took power in a coup in 1994, beginning a brutal and sometimes bizarre administration that jailed opponents and journalists, hunted people thought to be witches, and unleashed fear so intense that even Gambians who had fled to Senegal were afraid he was spying on them. On his last night in the country, Yahya Jammeh rolled toward his flight into exile in his trademark Rolls Royce. Flanked by a motorcade, the vehicle cruised down the wide streets of Banjul, the capital, as Mr. Jammeh headed to the airport on Saturday after finally agreeing to give up the presidency. And it turns out the Rolls Royce went with him. The vehicle was loaded onto a cargo plane accompanying the president. He also departed with a second Rolls Royce, a Mercedes-Benz, and other cars and luxury items, according to an airport official and a diplomat familiar with activities in the country." Probably shouldn't be surprised, should we, Benjamin?
No, I think, and let's see what Asan has to say about this, but because Asan was actually in the Gambia only in December and January, visiting family and friends and doing research. But, I mean, Jammeh was notoriously corrupt. You look at transparency. Transparency International's reports over the last two decades, and they will talk about Gambia. You know, he was a president, so he had a presidential salary, not the type of salary that could make it possible to buy such things. So he's extraordinarily corrupt, and he pilfered the state, and he left with a good part of the state's budget. What do you think, Hassan?
Yeah, no, that is true. Over the past two decades, he had accumulated a lot of money, which he took from the state coffers, and people around him had been enriched by him, because he was notorious in giving a lot of cash to his political allies and religious leaders and students even. I remember teaching at the University of the Gambia one summer, maybe about 3 years ago, and he had given to the Gambia Student Union of the University of the Gambia, he gave them $200,000. And that was not the only time I read about things like that or actually witnessed something similar. So he's notoriously corrupt. No doubt.
And in a moment, I want to talk about refugees and what happens next, and whether we know just how many Gambian refugees there are around the world. Before we do that, let's make sure we understand this changeover in power, because unfortunately, when you have an outgoing leader who has been essentially a dictator or an authoritarian, they're not always replaced by someone who is interested in human rights and the will of the people. But Benjamin, you said before the hour began, you're optimistic about this, yes?
Yeah, I think both Hassan and I are optimistic.
Okay.
And the later guest, who the three of us have co-authored an article about the Gambia, about this sudden change in the political context, we're optimistic. I mean, who knows what Adama Barrow will be like, but he's part of a organized opposition that united for the first time for this particular presidential election. And I know Hassan has some strong opinions about this too, but we are of the opinion that this is really unprecedented. There's never been a case where a dictator has gone to the polls. I mean, he was elected, but he was an authoritarian leader who ruled in the manner of a dictator. He rose to power militarily. So there's never been a case in African history where someone has put themselves to the polls without assuming they're going to win. I'm sure he assumed he was going to win. Everybody was shocked. So the opposition, most of them did not think they would win.
And Professor Saar, that to me says that whatever the structure for counting the votes for this election was probably legitimate, that as Benjamin says, dictators don't like to go to the polls unless they know the results in advance, but somehow this held up to actual scrutiny and allowed people to vote pretty freely, yes?
Yes, I mean, that's absolutely correct. I agree with Ben 100% that he thought that he was going to pull it off again. But to his dismay, he lost the election. And what was remarkable about this was that many foreign governments and organizations actually stayed away. They didn't send election observers.
That's right.
But Gambians generally had faith in the system, and they went, even though the opposition, I think they were careful in their optimism. I have a number of Gambian students here at Ohio University. Only one of these many students actually was optimistic that the outcome of the election would see Jammeh out of power. I was skeptical. So this came as a huge surprise, but it goes to show how important it was for the various opposition parties to come together to unite against Jammeh, because one of the ways in which he was able to perpetuate himself in power was that he manipulated ethnicity, manipulated the different sections of society, the religious elites, use the military, the army, use the National Assembly. And as a result, I think for the past 20-some years, he was able to just keep the country divided in many ways, even though others also claim that the previous elections were hardly free and fair, and there is some truth to that. But I think this time he was surprised, and many of us were also surprised, because but it was absolutely transparent, very free and fair, and I think that's what one of the reasons why this is so remarkable.
You know, Ahsan, I think what's really interesting, perhaps to our listeners, is that the electoral process involved this almost sort of ancient Athenian process of dropping marbles into barrels that would ring a bell. So you could see that, you could hear that there's only one, not two. And they were counted openly in a public setting. And, you know, we've heard, and we, the two of us and our other collaborators, we've read news stories where they've kind of, I don't want to say poo-pooed, but they've kind of ridiculed or played with this notion somehow as if it's some sort of primitive democratic process. But in fact, it's an ancient practice that goes back to Athens.
And harder to falsify, right?
And much harder to falsify. And in this particular climate right now where we're discussing whether or not there were millions of fraudulent votes in the past presidential election.
Which there weren't, but yeah. Right.
Which there were not, of course. There's no evidence of that. But here we have a very transparent process. And and it was in the public eye. People could watch the process of voting and they watched the process of counting. And it also is very hard to suddenly manipulate the results.
Yes.
And the big innovation this year was that the results were announced immediately. And there wasn't some sort of there was an independent National Electoral Commission which announced the results. And so once that news was out, there was very little that JAMA could actually do.
And let me ask Benjamin and Professor Saar, I'll ask you if what I had read was also correct here, in that JAMA had boxed himself in a little bit here, in that if you want to know how do authoritarians hold on to power, what he had done is a pretty common maneuver, which is whenever you sense a potential rival or anyone you might not trust, you get them out of government. And so he would haphazardly over the last 22 years, he would just dismiss cabinet members, and sometimes seemingly without reason, he would dismiss judges. Well, all of a sudden now he decides he wants to challenge the results that I could not have lost, but they didn't have the Supreme Court to do it. And then even JAMA couldn't have installed four new justices to lead a recount effort that would be viewed with any legitimacy, and that he had put so many holes into government that he couldn't fill them with any legitimacy, and it ultimately was his undoing. Professor Saar, is that correct?
That is so correct. Actually, everything fell apart for him. It was like, an earthquake that, affected all the institutions, all the sections of government that he once controlled so tightly. You're absolutely right. I think we should even go back to the arrest and subsequent jailing of the main opposition politician at the time, lawyer Useinu Dabo of the United Democratic Party. So by arresting him, he thought he was actually crushing the opposition, because that's the only guy he thought could remove him from power. But by arresting him, unfortunately for Dabo and the nation, he paved the way for Barrow to come from nowhere. And he thought probably that, oh, this guy, nobody knows him. He shall never win, let alone become the guy who would displace me from power. So then his ministers were resigning one by one. Some army officers, I don't think this gets a lot of attention, but some army officers, not senior but middle ranking officers, were fleeing the country, worried that the what was about to come was not good. I was in the Gambia from December 10th to January 8th, so I was there during the during the crisis. So there were officers leaving. But then the Supreme Court, I mean, the Gambia Bar Association said, okay, we are staying away from all of this. So he did not even get the courts to actually work on his side. And historically, I think I can say that the court was very, over the past several years, very supportive of him, to be frank.
That's right. But
he lost that. He lost the... I think the National Assembly stood by him up to the last minute. But overall, I think, you know, the Supreme Court, he had fired all the judges but one, the Chief Justice. So he had trouble actually recruiting Supreme Court judges to hear the case. So everything fell apart for him. I think if he were to know that this would be the outcome, he would not have suppressed the Supreme Court the way he did.
Right. And he probably would not have accepted the results first and then changed his mind later on. So, I mean, I think you're right, Hassan. You summarized it nicely. He had disassembled the state. And, you know, what I thought might be interesting to people is to think about, why do people flee the Gambia? And one of the reasons, I mean, you mentioned that he dismissed ministers and he dismissed judges, but he also imprisoned people and killed people. I mean, he had a targeted killing list that he had his militias go out and seek out particular people. Targeted journalists were murdered. Later on in this hour, we're going to talk to a journalist who himself was imprisoned and tortured and experienced persecution and became a refugee here in the United States. And so, I mean, he attacked every sector of the state. And in so doing, he really created the context for his own demise, we might say. But I think the idea of the bait and switch also upset other West African nations. And so we can't leave out the fact that the organization of West African states, referred to as ECOWAS really got involved early on. And they determined that it was in their interest to stand behind a democratic process. And, you know, so Gambia is an unusual place geographically insofar as it's surrounded by the country of Senegal. And so ECOWAS, with the Senegalese and the Nigerian and the Liberian and the Ghanaian governments speaking very loudly, decided that they were not going to tolerate JAMA holding on to power. And that has not really happened before. There have been a few sort of precedents that there was an invasion of Sierra Leone by ECOWAS. There are other precedents in other parts of Africa. The deposing of Idi Amin back in 1979 by Tanzania is another precedent. But this is a pretty unusual use of power by a regional authority. And suddenly, JAMA had nowhere to go.
Professor Sarr, again, for listeners who may think, well, this is sort of an esoteric topic, I'm hoping that, number one, we're interested in events around the world, no matter where it happens, if it's related to human rights, refugees, political prisonerships, freedom of journalists. I mean, that's all at the heart of the Gambian story. Is it possible, is it possible that what Benjamin just described, this move to making sure that the votes were respected, could this have any impact in other parts of Africa that may also need that kind of support, or is this going to be a one-off?
No, I think overall, I agree with Benjamin. I think he makes a very, very important and valid point about the role of the ECOWAS and the uniqueness of the Gambian case here. But I think if we also look at the role that ECOWAS has been playing over the past few years. I mean, if Benjamin recall, a few years ago, ECOWAS tried to convince member states to actually impose a presidential term limit. And Gambia does not have one. And Gambia was one of two countries that actually rejected that proposal. If you look at also what the ECOWAS has done in neighboring Guinea-Bissau, neighbor to Senegal, south of the Gambia and southern Senegal, where the government was very weak and unstable, they kind of sent a force there to kind of maintain peace and security and promote democratic institutions. I think the Gambian case is a bit unique in the sense that Jammeh irritated all his neighbors, including Senegal. I mean, his West African colleagues did not want to see him there. That's right. I don't have any direct evidence to this, but if you recall, Benjamin, just over the summer, last summer, Senegal had established a blockade of Gambia.
That's right. That's right.
You know, the border crisis was the longest in the history of the two countries. I mean, I went to the Gambia at that time. I mean, you can see the impact that had on the Gambian economy because the relationship between the two countries had just gone sour. It's been always a very murky relationship. It has always been like that. There was a confederation back then in the 80s during the Jawara's government. But then Jammeh had just not developed a very good relationship with his neighbors. And I think that added to the reason why ECOWAS, I think, wanted to get him out. And they also knew that the human rights record of his government was just awful. When people talk about, for example, Eritrea, which is also very notorious for violating human rights and so on, and a lot of Eritreans are also traveling across the Mediterranean, being refugees elsewhere. And rarely do we hear about the Gambia, but I think the Gambia was probably worse than any African country.
Hassan, I have to say, that really is the big picture here. That is, I think, why ECOWAS and other outside forces supported ECOWAS in doing what they did, because the refugee crisis coming out of the Gambia has become such a problem for Europe that they're actually providing financial and military support to West African nations to keep their populations in West Africa. Just recently, the French government provided large funds to Burkina Faso and Mali to find mechanisms to hold people back in their country and to discourage them from traveling across the Mediterranean or the Sahara. And so the bigger picture here is that the refugee crisis is the underbelly of this story, right? The thousands of Gambians fleeing from human rights violations, from gender violence, and from basic poverty and unemployment. These are the things that are embarrassing West African nations, and it came up in the prelude to the election too.
Well, let me let Professor Sarr go, and then what we'll do is we'll take our only break of the hour. We're going to come back and key in on the question of refugees, what happens next, and you are going to hear from a journalist and newspaper editor who went into exile from the Gambia in 2000 before the hour is up. Professor Sarr at Ohio University, my alma mater. It's nice to hear.
Thank you. I'm glad to hear that you were here.
Bobcat Pride, how are things in Athens?
Good. Very nice.
It's a beautiful place. Professor Sarr, our honor having you. Thank you for taking the time for the program.
Thank you so much, and thank you, Ben.
Thank you.
Hassan Sarr is an assistant professor of history at Ohio University. Let's get our only break of the hour. We'll come back with Benjamin Loris, who is the Connable Chair and Director of International and Global Studies at RIT. We're talking about the recent crisis in the Gambia, which is now a great opportunity. Finally, the departure of a strong man who'd been there for more than two decades and a chance to right some wrongs when it comes to human rights and a refugee crisis and more. So we continue that conversation next. I'm Evan Dawson, Thursday on The Next Connections. What would Susan B. Anthony say about the current political environment? The Susan B. Anthony Museum and House is hosting its annual birthday luncheon next month, but first we'll talk to the event's keynote speaker, scholar Ann Dexter Gordon, about how Anthony's work connects to current events. Then in our second hour, the third African-American Roman Catholic female priest will be ordained on Saturday, and she's in Rochester. Reverend Myra Brown joins us in studio. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Benjamin Lawrence is my guest in studio, the Director of International and Global Studies at RIT. And we're talking about a small nation in West Africa that has a new leader as of just a few days ago. There was an election in, when was the actual election, Benjamin?
So the election took place on the 1st, and the results were announced more or less immediately, the evening, well, the morning here. So we were, that is me and my colleagues in African Studies, were attending the African Studies meeting in D.C. when we heard the results, and there was just complete surprise.
I was going to say, I have to imagine it was, you know, just imagine a situation where you had an authoritarian. The feeling that if elections aren't rigged, they're essentially rigged, or, you know, authoritarians don't usually consent to elections unless they can control the results, and that wasn't the case here. So you have a new leader coming in, and when it comes to refugees, Benjamin made a point in the first half hour that I'd like you to make again here. Tell me again, in terms of the Gambia, just the relation to refugees around the world.
Yeah, so Gambia has produced an enormous volume of refugees for the relatively small population of about just over 2 million. Last year, the number of Gambians arriving in Italy across the Mediterranean on flimsy rafts and boats was the single largest number of from an African nation. So they're the, incredibly overrepresented. Now, what that tells us is that something is terribly wrong. If people are fleeing their country in extraordinary numbers, compared to other countries, including the neighboring country of Senegal, which surrounds and is relatively prosperous and very democratic, surrounds the Gambia. That tells you that something is going on. Just in the last year alone, a famous wrestler died in a boat that sank in the Mediterranean. The women's national football team goalkeeper died in a boat that sank in the Mediterranean. So these cases really pinpoint Gambia as a place of intense desperation. So Jammeh has been in power, was in power for 22 years. He came to power via a military coup, and then he changed the constitution, and he had elections every 5 years or so. And each time an opposition figure was ran against him and lost, and Gambia was quote-unquote re-elected. But most of those elections were never judged externally to be free and fair. And over the last couple of years, the migration crisis, or the refugee crisis is what I prefer to call it, has really eclipsed Gambia in terms of its national narrative. When you talk, if you go to Europe, or if you talk to immigration authorities in Britain or in Italy or in France, Gambia and Eritrea, these relatively small countries by population, are at the top of the asylum and refugee application list. So something, we know a lot more about Eritrea. The mandatory military conscription, indefinite military conscription for all citizens in Eritrea is one of the main reasons. That has been called by the United Nations as slavery. So they have identified Eritrea as reintroducing slavery. We know why people are fleeing Eritrea. We know quite a bit less about Gambia because this despotic dictatorship for so long has managed to persecute journalists, politicians. It's very hard to get reliable information, closing down access to the internet, closing down, bombing newspapers, bombing radio stations. So he has had control over the information about the Gambia. We know about the Gambia from only the people who leave. So I've worked as an expert witness, and we talked about that before, in asylum claims. And the stories of these asylum claims, the stories they tell us are horrific, right? The famous Three Mile Island prison, which was visited by the U.S. ambassador to the Gambia a couple of years ago, and he was mortified by what he saw. It's also been visited by the United Nations Special Rapporteur on Torture and Inhumane Punishment. It was the worst prison he'd ever seen. And so we know, you know, small details of, you know, the types of incarceration and torture and persecution that goes on, but it's mostly from people who flee. And so that really shapes the way we think about the Gambia, because if there are so many people leaving, then there's obviously something very wrong going on in the country. And it's not simply the case of poverty and unemployment. Poverty and unemployment affect most countries in Africa, and they, of course, affect here in the United States. Poverty and unemployment is a persistent problem, particularly bad in parts of West Africa. But in the Gambia, it has been the ongoing persecution of any opposition, any political parties that try to rival Jemma. He's also had complete control over the army, the national police, and several sort of semi-private militias who would arrest people, detain them incommunicado, extrajudicially. And the stories of torture that came out of the Gambia from people who fled have been particularly harrowing. So all of these sort of forces have really shaped what we know about the Gambia. And many people who flee and seek asylum abroad win their asylum claims because we have rich documentation of what's going on. Journalists who've been targeted and murdered. We have politicians who've been imprisoned, including the leader of the opposition, which is one of the reasons why Jemma lost. He imprisoned his main rival, and suddenly seven opposition parties united behind an unexpected individual, and they suddenly felt motivated to go to the polls. I mean, I would say in summary, what's going on in the Gambia is really a very useful case study for understanding why people flee, why they seek refuge, what protections do they seek when they go on these horrendous journeys. I mean, for every, by some accounts, for every one or two people who make themselves, who get across the Sahara, there may be two or three who never even make it. So it gives you some sense of the volume. And the same goes for the boats. We don't know exactly.
Rafts on the ocean.
Yeah, we don't know how many people disappear because they are on these small boats sailing up the coast, sailing into the Mediterranean, then walking over land and then getting on other boats. We don't even have any way to know how many people die on the way. But to get into one of those flimsy rafts and to try to cross an ocean is a sign of intense desperation.
And what's the best hope now for refugees? Are there refugees, by the way, Gambian refugees in Rochester that we know?
Well, you know, I actually reached out to a few people, and I haven't managed to track down. But if there are any, I would love to learn about their experiences.
I was going to say, Benjamin, if there are, I suspect you'll find your way to them. And we have a refugee community that is a rich and really beautiful and bigger community than I think a lot of people realize in Rochester, so it wouldn't surprise me. And what's the best hope for Gambians abroad now who are looking at this saying, wow, Jemma is gone, we perhaps could think about it. Is this an opportunity to go home?
Well, I think, you know, we just heard from my colleague and friend Hassan Sa, who went back in December. Now, he is not a political refugee, so he has been going back and forth for many years. But for other people, like our next guest, Baba Jallo, he has not been able to go back. And I would love to know whether he's thinking about doing that. Certainly, the prisons have been opened. Opposition activists have been released. The new president is going to transform that country. I think he's going to face some resistance by people who are members of the parliament. Certainly members of the paramilitaries are going to have to be sort of demobilized, and the state police, the state guards, the henchmen for Jemma for 20 years who have really lost their patron, they're going to be still a bit of a threat, and I would be concerned. I wouldn't be rushing home. But I think in terms of also refugee and asylum claims today from the Gambia, it's going to be harder to make the case that you're going to be in danger. Unless perhaps, you know, for some cases like domestic violence, LGBT cases, those are people who will, I think, continue to face difficulties.
I was just listening to a podcast. Listeners, I love Crime Town, which tells the story of Providence and mafia crime in Providence over the decades. And a man who was elected in 1974, Buddy Cianci, was elected on this reform banner, but the mob helps elect him, and he ended up, as you might expect, kind of tied up in crime. And later, before he died, he did an interview in which he said, "No elected leader anywhere wakes up in the morning and thinks, how can I help the poor? How can I help the sick? How can I help the elderly? It's always about ego and what can I do to control more political power." Mm-hmm. Now, that's an American mayor, but that's a comment that should frighten anybody when it comes to elected politics. And the hope is that the person who succeeds Jemma is at least going to be more interested in human rights.
Yes.
But it sounds like you're more concerned with, as you say, paramilitary police, you know, the control of those armed forces.
The transition period is very delicate, right? He has to assert authority over the military as the commander-in-chief. It's a small army, but it's still you know, a group of people who for 20 years have been loyal to Jammeh. Jammeh is now in exile in the most despotic country, which is Equatorial Africa. Equatorial Guinea in Central Africa. That's where the longest ruling dictator in Africa lives, and he's gone to hide there after fleecing the national treasury. But I would be very concerned for the first few months. Let's see what happens.
Let me welcome on the phone Dr. Baba Jallo, who's an assistant professor of African and world history at LaSalle University in Philadelphia. And before going into exile in 2000, Baba was a journalist and a newspaper editor in The Gambia. Dr. Jallo, thank you for taking the time. How are you?
Thank you. I'm good.
Can you tell us about your own story about exile and what happened to you and the work that you were doing as a journalist, you know, what life was like in that nation before your exile?
I became a journalist a week after the military coup in 1994 that brought Yahya Jammeh to power. I started out as assistant editor of the Daily Observer, which was a daily newspaper. And then about 3 years later, I became editor-in-chief of that paper. And I was arrested several times as editor of the Observer. And in 1999, someone very close to Jammeh bought the paper. And so I resigned and started the independent newspaper in July of 1999. And again, I had a lot of run-ins with the Jammeh regime. They firebombed our offices several times. They burnt our press, which we got from the German government. And eventually, in April of 2000, both my parents were arrested. I was accused of not being a Gambian. And eventually, after my parents were arrested, you know, they felt that, you know, they couldn't sleep anymore. So, you know, I had to go into exile. And that's how I came to the U.S. on exile in September 2000.
Dr. Jallo, when, as you say, someone close to the leader of the country bought the paper in 1999 and you decided to do independent journalism, how aware were you that you were putting your own life at risk doing that?
Oh, I knew. I mean, I had no doubt that I would be in conflict with the government. Before the paper was bought by Amadou Samba, who was very close to the president, we were having problems with the government because of our independent editorial policy. So when they bought the paper, they wanted to change that. And I couldn't work within a media environment that had no independent editorial policy. And so I knew that it wasn't going to be easy. But I believe that it was necessary for the Gambia to have at least one independent newspaper that was going to assist in keeping sanity, you know, in making sure that people's rights were respected. So I knew I was going to get into trouble.
Benjamin Lawrence has been sharing his thoughts, his reaction to the stunning, well, I say stunning, I mean, that's the characterization of a lot of people who know so much more about the Gambia than people like me, the stunning results of the election. What did you think of the results of the election?
Well, I think the results were fair. I think that the elections happened at a time when everyone, including his own people, had become tired of Jammeh. They wanted an end to the dictatorship, and there was this coalition that brought together several political parties. And so the moment was right for people to vote Jammeh out, and they did it. I think he was disappointed that, unlike previous electoral commissions, this particular electoral commission didn't steal the elections for him. But I was surprised that he won, but that Barrow won. But I knew that, you know, that the time was right to change government.
Dr.
And apparently, a lot of people felt like that too.
Yeah. Dr. Jallo, when you were in journalism, when you were a journalist and newspaper editor in the Gambia, I'm sure you had colleagues as well, who felt some of the same concerns you did for your own well-being. Were how much were you aware of either journalists in the Gambia, as you did, going into exile or fleeing in some regard, or being imprisoned? Mm-hmm. I mean, what was the typical outcome for journalists eventually in the Gambia?
Well, at the time I left, around that time, journalists had two options. One, they could censor themselves. They could practice self-censorship, which some of the newspapers did to a lesser or larger degree. or they could decide to cling on to the principle of independent journalism and therefore fall into trouble. And when they fall into trouble with the regime, they could get killed, as we have seen. Some journalists have been killed in Gambia. Or they could go into exile, or they could repeatedly be arrested and possibly tortured, as we have also seen happen to some journalists in the Gambia. So it wasn't a very conducive environment for journalism in 2000, and it just got worse over the years.
I think right now with the climate in our country, with the changeover in power and the concerns about journalistic freedom, I this makes me think of a couple of things. Number one, I think it's vital to stay on guard to protect press freedom. Number two, there are some legitimate concerns here, but boy, they're nothing like hearing about firebombs in offices and journalists being either killed, put into prisons, or going into exile. And you certainly hope that you never end up there. But Dr. Jallo, how important do you think a free press is to any nation, to the Gambia, to African nations, to nations that want to protect human rights?
Well, I think a free press is absolutely important to the freedom of the citizens, to, you know, the protection of the lives and liberties and properties, if you like, of a nation. I think a nation gets into trouble if there is no freedom of expression, which could also translate into freedom of association and all the other freedoms that are supposed to be natural to human nature. But I think a free press is absolutely important, and especially in Africa, you know, in developing countries where a large number of people are not actually aware in a very direct sense of the things that are at stake. In other words, you know, they don't know what the constitutional provisions are that protects their own rights. They don't know what the dangers of authoritarianism is. You know, I think in Africa that is extremely vital that you have a free and vibrant press, that freedom of association is protected. In the United States, you know, I might be concerned about what's going on, but I know that a very critical mass of Americans know exactly what is at stake, and they could go out there and demonstrate and, you know, protest and even file suits against the government if need be. Which is not something that until now, perhaps in the Gambia in particular, we could do. You know, there are no protests, we are not allowed. You couldn't file a suit against the government, or if you did, you were wasting your time because the courts were controlled by the regime. But I think freedom of expression is absolutely vital to the well-being of society.
Okay. Well, go ahead, Benjamin, you want to jump
in? I just
in?
Wanted to ask Baba, I was wondering, when do you think it might be safe for you or people like you who have fled as refugees to go back to somewhere like the Gambia?
Well, I think it's safe to go now. The only thing preventing me from going now is that we are in the middle of a semester. The spring semester has already started. So I think if I had my way, I would go right away and visit. You know, I've not been there for 17 years. It's a long time for someone to be in exile. But, yeah, I think right now people can go visit.
So let me ask Benjamin and then Dr. Jallo the same question, and I think this is vital now. If we are going to see the advancement of human rights, if we're going to see opportunity for refugees to return to their homes if they want to, if we're going to see countries where journalists are not imprisoned and presses are allowed to be free, I'm wondering what you think is the most important sort of next steps coming here to protect this, to guard against another regime, another leadership that ends up much like the last. It seems to be very difficult to make those kinds of strides and to maintain them. How do you think that can come about, Benjamin?
Well, I think somewhere like the Gambia became despotic partly because people didn't care about it. It was a relatively small country, relatively insignificant, although now we know that it's not in terms of numbers of refugees. It's become significant for unfortunate reasons. So I think being globally aware of what's going on in specific countries, I think there's a lot of importance in investing in electoral monitoring. The United States has a small government dimension to it. But mostly it's through private organizations such as the Carter Center or the National Endowment for Democracy. But in other parts of the world, it's a government enterprise, the European Union, the African Union. They involve themselves heavily in electoral monitoring because they know that there's a bigger thing going on. There's a bigger context. And so doing anything we can to enhance democratic processes is very important. And I would echo some of the things that Barbara said in terms of the free press. Access to a free and transparent and publicly owned press is very important. So guarding against co-optation by government, guarding against monopolization or centralization of press by one particular individual or groups of individuals or companies, ensuring free and transparent equal access to the internet. I'd be interested to know from Baba what he thinks about how the internet access shifted the dimension in the Gambia since he left. Because a lot of newspapers popped up in the U.S. in the diaspora to make it possible. But those are the things that I would prioritize.
Yeah, Dr. Jalo, you want to add to that?
Yeah, certainly. Just to start with what you said about the internet media, within the past 16 years, a lot of media groups have risen, you know, mainly run by journalists who are in exile, Gambian journalists who are in exile. You have the Freedom newspaper, you have Cairo News, you have Mafanta, you have a lot of Gambian online media run by journalists. And they have been persistently attacking and criticizing the government and spreading awareness of the abuses of the German government. You know, I have myself been writing like persistently, consistently over the past 16 years in this online media, but also on online Gambian listservs. I think in addition to that, the use of Facebook has kind of bloomed, you know, just kind of very, very largely increased among Gambians. A lot of Gambians, young Gambians, are on Facebook now. You know, they have Twitter accounts and so on and so forth. And so this information, this critical information about the Gambian regime has been very, very much spread through online media, both newspapers and you know, social media. And in addition to that, going back to your first question about how a free press might be guaranteed in the Gambia, I think the first thing that the new government should do is to repeal all the draconian media laws that are in the books right now, you know, including newspaper amendment acts, you know, that increase the fees for the registration of newspapers, you know, imposing very, very heavy jail terms and fines on journalists for libel, defamation, and so on. I think all of those should be removed. Mm-hmm. At the same time, you know, there are certain provisions in the Gambian constitution that also restrict freedom of association and freedom of expression. I think those need to be repealed as well. Now, in addition to that, one point that I think is vitally important is that the political culture of the country needs to be transformed. It needs to be transformed from, you know, what it has been since independence and even before independence, which is that the institutions of constitutionalism are not aligned to the people's perceptions and understandings of government. I think that is vitally important. And I am involved in a project right now, in launching a particular project that is designed to engage in civic education and the empowerment of the Gambian people. I think that's important because if people are enlightened politically about their rights, then it becomes very difficult for any particular regime to impose on them and oppress them.
Mm-hmm. Benjamin, can I just ask you to kind of close up here a little bit here? A lot of us who are learning about the Gambia through the recent news, again, it's surrounded by Senegal, water to the west and then surrounded by Senegal. And as you say, Senegal has much more democratic traditions, yes?
It has. It's had a number of peaceful transitions between different parties and different leaders, and it's never had a military coup. And the Gambia has a lot to learn from Senegal.
But shouldn't that give us hope that at least it's surrounded by some stability?
I think that's a factor. But there's also rivals and tensions that are ongoing. And in fact, Baba hinted at that when he mentioned that before he fled, he was accused of not being a Gambian. And this is a classic technique that governments use to question whether you have a right to be involved in a national conversation. So often Jama would victimize his opponents by calling them Senegalese. Or he would call them maybe from Guinea and say that they're actually not Gambian nationals or their parents were not Gambian. Mm-hmm. And this was, of course, one of the root causes of the conflict that spiraled into the Ivoirian Civil War that lasted 10 years and cost hundreds of thousands of lives. So this is not something that's just in the Gambia, but it's a classic technique that authoritarian regimes use. So questioning anyone's nationality, questioning anyone's patriotism. Baba mentioned the draconian laws targeting journalists, but there's also a sedition law in the Gambia, which basically criminalizes any form of criticism. And it also made me think when he mentioned that with the libel laws. And I remember in the prelude to our presidential election that Donald Trump several times, particularly during his sit down with the Washington Post, said that he would like to
loosen the libel laws
yeah. so that they can really clamp down on criticisms of individuals. And this is that's what authoritarian leaders do. That's what Jammeh did. That's what other presidents and dictators in West Africa have done. And they have used that to cement authoritarian power.
Well, we shall be following the situation going forward. We are out of time, but I wanted to thank Dr. Jallo, Assistant Professor of African and World History at LaSalle University, for sharing his personal story. Dr. Jallo, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you for having me.
And Benjamin Lawrence, who is the Conable Chair and Director of International and Global Studies at RIT. A lot of lessons here, and at least a hope that as we think about the many people who might have been lost at sea or lost in a desert and their names will never be known, there may be other refugees still living who have a much more hopeful future now. And thank you for at least updating us on what's going on in the Gambia. I appreciate it.
Thank you. My pleasure.
All right. Our thanks to Rob Braden, the engineer, Megan Mack, producer. I'm Evan Dawson. Have a great afternoon. Talk to you Thursday.